Okay. Wanted to just recap where we finished off last week, and then take it from there. So last week we saw the first presentation, so to speak, of the various different individuals who come before the King of the Kesars, trying to convince him to adapt their way of life. So we saw a philosopher comes first, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the author of the Kuzari, intentionally sticks the philosopher really as the first of the presentations, because we said that Greek philosophy through the Arab world, through the Muslim world, was making a tremendous impact on the Jews during the medieval period. So it was very, very important to have some kind of response to philosophy. And we saw that the philosopher who comes and says his piece, you know, you could hear why it was so attractive to the Jews of that time. On the one hand, it's very different from Torah and Yiddishkeit in that it preaches that God is totally removed from everything having to do with the world. God is so beyond human life that there can't be any meaningful interaction between God and the human beings in the world in any which way. God is only concerned with the world, which, according to the philosophers, lasts forever. Okay, so that's very clearly not a Jewish idea, right? In Torah, we certainly believe that God communicates to us, that God cares about us, that God is interested in our mitzvahs, He wants us to do things. But on the other hand, then the philosopher starts describing how every person is supposed to try to raise himself up to the highest madrega, to the highest level of shleimus, of human perfection, and that a person is supposed to keep building himself and building himself and building himself until he becomes one with the quote-unquote the active intellect, the great brain, so to speak, which is up there in the heavens, which a person plugs into through his self-perfection and improvement. And says the philosopher, and if a person actually reaches this level, so he's going to become immortal, he's going to have Lichtige Gan Eden together with all the great philosophers of history, he'll be sitting there with Plato and Aristotle, Socrates, and the entire Chevra up there. And what's more, says the philosopher, if a person really achieves this level of Shleimus, of human perfection, he can actually become a Navi. You know, the philosophers, again, that's not what we associate with philosophy today, but the philosophers of the Middle Ages did not discount the idea of nevuah, of prophecy. They believed in it. They believed that although God doesn't care enough about human beings to want to communicate to people directly, since you're plugged in, if you're a great philosopher, you're plugged in to the great brain which is up there in Shamayim, so you can find out, you can be one with the great wisdom of God Himself. And part of being one with that wisdom of God is being able to know about the various things which are going to happen in the future, and having that degree of prophecy, you know, by virtue of becoming a great philosopher. Right? So says the philosopher to the king, I've outlined for you this incredible way of life. Again, there's certain aspects of it where you can almost, if you close your eyes, which at this time of night it's not so hard to do, but if you close your eyes and you just, you think, you know, you change the voice and change some of the phrases a little bit, it's almost like a mashkiach in a yeshiva, the havdil. In other words, the stress on shleimus, the stress on human perfection and self-improvement and all these sort of things, those resonated very much, no doubt, with a Jewish audience at that time. And, you know, very encouraging to anyone who's trying to look for the truth, you know, capital T. So says the philosopher to the king of the Kesars, I think I have the way of life which is perfect for you, and let's see if you bite. Where we left off, where we're going to pick up with, is where the king refuses to bite. Right? So basically says the king back as follows, and again, we're working on the svar, Bez Hashem, but if you have one, you can certainly follow. Amar HaKuzari, Roe ani dvorecho nechochim maspikim, ach eno mafikim l'sheilosi, b'pnei shani odea ba'atzmi ki nafshi zaka, You said something very good. The king of the Kesar says to this philosopher, but it still doesn't address my particular question. If you recall, the philosopher among his remarks had said that once you try to do what you understand as right, according to the wisdom of the philosophers throughout the ages, the exact rituals which you follow are really unimportant. The philosopher told the king of the Kesars, you know, you want to have a religion, you want to feel like you're doing some kind of ritual, great, okay, so make up a religion. Do whatever you want. You know, there's no specific thing which you have to do, which is necessary. There is a concept known as objective truth. He's not totally subjective. But objective truth is about achieving a certain kind of character, certain types of character traits, a certain kind of inner wisdom. You know, the exact ritual components which you have, the exact activities which you do, you know, the exact karbana, so to speak, that you bring, the exact sacrifices, the exact God that you worship, all of that is really secondary. Make something up for yourself, the philosopher tells the king of the Kesars. So says the king of the Kesars, that's fine and good, but I had a revelation. I had an angel come to me in a dream, and the angel told me that although your intentions are very, very good, somehow your maisim, your actual actions are lacking. The angel told me there's some kind of objective truth out there, which I'm supposed to discover, and your subjective, you can do this, you can do that, you know, as long as you're striving for philosophical truth, this doesn't seem to resonate with what I was told from the Malach. Vim einanu ken, and there must be some kind of objective truth out there, says the king of the Kesars to the philosopher. Because if not, mala edom uli yishmel shechilku ayishuv nilchomim ze bozeh. So says the king of the Kesars to the philosopher, if there was no objective truth out there, why is it that the Christians and the Muslims are constantly fighting with one another? Right? I mean, the whole history of the Middle Ages, and one might argue the history of the world up till this day, is basically about wars, you know, going on between the Christians and the Muslims. I mean, Spain itself, where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived, was a case in point. You know, for half of the Middle Ages, it was in the hands of the Muslims. For half of the Middle Ages, it was reconquered by the Christians and became a Christian country. The Christian, you know, Christianity and Islam were basically warring constantly over different parts of the world, who would control what. And says the king of the Kesars to the philosopher, well, if religion doesn't really matter, if it's all about achieving some kind of philosophical truth, and there is no objective religion, so what are all these people fighting about? Now, you might say, okay, maybe they're not fighting about anything, right? I mean, who says, just because they're fighting about something doesn't mean that either of them are right, right? So we'll come back, we'll address that in a moment or two. V'chol echad mehem zako nafsho v'kavonoso le'elokim. Each of these sides, the Muslims on the one side, the Christians on the other side, each one believes that he's absolutely correct, and that, you know, he's doing what God wants. V'nivdal v'nivrosh v'tzamu mispalil. And the representatives of each religion, they separate themselves what they consider to be wrong, and they fast, and they pray, and they do everything which they consider to be right. But when they get involved in these religious wars between the Christians and the Muslims, with all of the fasting and the praying and all of that, each one has the intention to go and kill the guy on the other side. The more things change, the more they stay the same, right? And each side believes that his killing the guy on the other side is a tremendous act of piety, the kurva el habara yisparach, and will bring him closer to the Creator. V'chol echad ma'amin ki halichaso el gan Eden. And each one thinks that after he finishes killing the other guy, he's going to go straight to Gan Eden for this act of martyrdom, jihad, you know, fill in whatever you think is the appropriate term, you know, for this incredibly religious act, you know, he's going to go straight to Gan Eden. And therefore, given that the Muslims and the Christians both feel so, each one feels so passionately about the religion which they believe in, how can I take you seriously when you tell me that there is no objective truth out there? So on the surface, it's a very strange argument, right, for the king of the Kesars to reject philosophy based on this reason, because the truth is, you know, as the Aramaic phrase goes, one is tempted to say, ein hachinami. In other words, the very question is the answer. Well, you know, the philosopher, and we're going to see the philosopher in a moment, is going to say, well, that's exactly what makes my philosophy superior to these religious folks out there. These religious folks are going around killing people in the name of religion. And my philosophy, which I teach, is much more civilized, is much more humane. You know, it doesn't involve killing people because they disagree with you. Wouldn't you much rather be an adherent of a point of view that's as civilized as that, you know, rather than belonging to something which feels so passionately about its truth that it's ready to kill people over it? And in fact, the philosopher answers, Amar ha-pilosof, ein bedas ha-pilosofim harigas adam. There's nothing in our religion which would ever justify killing anybody else. Because ultimately we care about developing the mind. And you know, this notion of forced conversion of other people, or you know, killing people because they disagree with you, is utterly foreign from our point of view. So you would think, I mean, again, when you read that with 21st century sensitivities, so you're likely to think that the philosopher is totally right. And why does the fact that the Muslims and the Christians are killing one another, why is that a reason for the King of the Khazars to say there must be something there, as opposed to your religion or your point of view, the point of view of the philosopher? So Rabbi Karabkin, in his notes to the Kuzari, points out that philosophers themselves preached the idea that truth lies with the masses. That from a philosophical point of view, the very fact that tons of people believe something is a sign that there must be some truth to it. Aristotle argued that, and he quotes Lahavdil, the rabbi of Mar Nevuchim, advances a very similar argument in a different context. What exactly is that argument? I mean, what? Just because everybody believes something, or because of a lot of people believe something, it seems strange to argue that, you know, that's necessarily going to be true. In a sense, it's a paraphrase of, you know, what Abraham Lincoln said many, many centuries later. You know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. You know, ultimately, people have an intuitive sense when they feel something is true. I mean, Chazal say it as well in a different context, Nikarim divrei emes. Right? Chazal say, you can tell, truth has the ring of truth to it. And if so many people over so many centuries embrace something, right, there must be something true and correct there, even if we can't necessarily demonstrate it logically. So it seems like the King of the Khazars is making the following argument to the philosopher. And it's very interesting. He doesn't directly address any of the actual points in philosophy which the philosopher is making. But basically the King of the Khazars says as follows. The very fact that people throughout history have had this idea that there is a revealed religion and there is an objective truth, and people are so convinced of that idea that they're ready to lay down their lives. And yes, unfortunately, we disagree with them, but we see their passion in the fact that they're willing to kill for the sake of what they consider to be the truth. It can't be that so many people over so many years would be so passionate about something if there wasn't any truth to it whatsoever. So many people just can't be wrong. As much as the King of the Case is saying, I can appreciate the philosopher's point of view. He's very laid back and says, look, if we look at things logically, this is the way the world appears. That's very nice. But how do you explain the tremendous passion which so many people have put in to the idea of a truly revealed religion? There must be something there if so many people are ready to kill, literally, for that ideal. So the philosopher, yeah.
What if so many people don't, like now, so many people don't believe in God? Would that sound like such an insane thing to believe?
Right. So the truth is, if you really did a survey, I mean, as much as we hear a lot about atheism and the denial of belief in God, if you really did a survey of people in the world, I think you'd come out with many more people who believe in some sort of deity. Right.
It's not necessarily so.
Right. So I think you would draw a distinction between things which you can demonstrate empirically versus deep-set beliefs, which, you know, you can't necessarily demonstrate scientifically one way or the other. Throughout history, there's always been a belief in the afterlife. I mean, we find that, you know, going back, you know, as far as we can in many, many different cultures, you know, cultures share a belief that the soul remains on after death. The truth is, if somebody was a skeptic and came to you and said, you know, how do we know that the neshama survives after death? It's very, very hard to give the person scientific proofs of the existence and the immortality of the neshama. Very, very hard. Now, how are you going to prove it to somebody who's really skeptical? I think Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would argue, we don't have to give you a scientific proof. The very fact that this is a belief, again, not something you can demonstrate empirically, because then, you know, science can change. But something which is a question of belief and hashkafa, which has been held by so many people in so many different cultures throughout so many different centuries, you know, it indicates that there's something almost like hardwired into human beings which makes them believe that. Right? And that very fact is in itself a demonstration of sorts that, you know, there must be some truth to what we're talking about over here.
Just because we're hardwired for a certain emotional need to believe in a higher being, and that there is, that we need some sort of ritual in order to bring it, to give us a good feeling about it. Just because so many people believe in it, because they might be hardwired, but does not mean that it is this absolute truth out there. It's just a need that is being fulfilled by human beings, and that's why so many people might partake of this belief that, yes, there is a mission, there is an afterlife, there is a true religion, but does that mean that it's absolute truth?
Right, so 100%, it's not a scientific proof. But then you have to ask yourself, okay, so granted, let's start from the assumption that we believe in God. Okay, we'll start with that. And we want to try to demonstrate to somebody who believes in God but doesn't necessarily believe in an afterlife that there is such a thing as an afterlife. So he would respond exactly as you said, well, maybe God programmed every human being to believe in this because we have this need to believe in an afterlife. So then the next question I think would be, so why did God create human beings it's a little strange. Now, God created human beings and he implanted in them this need to believe in an afterlife, and he implanted in them the innate desire to believe in an afterlife, even though none of that is really true. I think at that point already, it's probably the more logical way of looking at things is, no, you know, the reason we all believe this innately is because the taka is an afterlife, and we're just reflecting some kind of, you know, basic understanding which we have, which God stuck into us, you know, from creation. Again, you know, is that an iron-proof argument which is going to, you know, convince somebody who's a skeptic? Not necessarily, you know. But I think the Kuzari is coming from that perspective. When so many people believe something, it makes you think that there must be something there.
You can't prove any of it.
You can't prove anything 100%. In fact, the whole thrust of the Kuzari is, we'll see time and time again, he's in a sense anti-philosophical. You know, whereas, you know, Rishonim like the Rambam tried to prove everything in neat, you know, geometric proofs, The Kuzari is not really interested in that. The Kuzari is much more interested in the proof that we derive from experience. You know, in other words, you know, I can prove you from here till tomorrow logically, but it's not necessarily going to work. But there's certain things we can experience, and we know that they're true, you know, even without necessarily being able to prove scientifically that they're true. I think here's a case in point right at the beginning of the Sefer. The philosopher is waxing poetic. Had the Rambam been writing the Kuzari, he would have taken point for point the various points of the philosopher and tried to slug them up, so to speak. He would have tried to refute them. But since Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who's coming from a very different perspective, is writing the Sefer, he's not interested in going point for point. He's coming from a totally different perspective. Experientially, what you're saying doesn't ring true. As you're talking about, you know, this whole system of thought, but experientially, we human beings all feel that there's some kind of objective truth which is revealed through religion, and throughout time we're even ready to kill people over, not us, but in other words, others are ready to kill people over this belief. So innately, human beings seem to feel that something is true.
Can't be
right.
I'll be
of right. the greatest mind to his own son.
Right.
And he knows that no matter what he's doing, there's a reason that he has to do it.
Right. And to the best of my knowledge, biographically, we don't have any stories about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi which are reminiscent of the Akedah, great, you know, trials of faith. We do know that he meant what he said, though. I mean, we know that he was a great Ohev Eretz Yisrael. He loved the land of Israel. And at the end of his life, we know that he left Spain to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. This was a little before Nefesh B'Nefesh, so it was somewhat more complicated back in the day, you know, than it is now. It's not simple nowadays either, right? But I mean, it was considerably more complicated back in the day. So, I mean, he was a person who was, I don't know that he went through nisyonos, you know, of trials quite like Avraham Avinu, but nonetheless, he was ready to put his money where his mouth was, you know, so to speak. So the philosopher comes back to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and says, yeah, but I mean, you know, we have this beautiful religion that doesn't require us to kill anybody. And the Kuzari says as follows. V'eizu dover shenota min ha'emetz eiso min ha'pilosofim godo me'emunosim sha'olam chadosh v'shu nivra b'shisha yomim v'sha'asiba rishonu medaberisim echob b'nei odom im ha'romos shemiromos ha'pilosofim midiyas ha'chelkiyus. That's the only complaint the king of the Kuzari has. The king of the Kuzari says to the philosophers, the only complaint you can have against organized religion is that they kill one another. I'll give you much better complaints that from your perspective you should have against organized religion. Organized religion, again, he's talking about Islam and Christianity. Organized religion believes that the world was created. Again, the philosophers did not. The philosophers believed that matter was eternal, at least the medieval Greek philosophers. They believe that matter was eternal. Organized religion believes that God directly communicates to human beings. You guys don't believe in that, right? You guys believe that God is not even interested in communicating with human beings. You totally disagree with the foundations of organized religion. So being that that's the case, and being that you believe that you philosophers are so superior to the representatives of organized religion, again, Islam, Christianity, and certainly Judaism, you would expect Hayoroi kufi masa pilosofim shetia nevua yedua bohem v'nimtseis beineyem v'nehi davkom beruchnius. We would expect that philosophers at some point or another would actually achieve nevua. It's a very interesting argument. Now again, you know, you talk to a modern-day philosopher, the modern-day philosopher isn't interested in prophecy whatsoever. I mean, that's kind of off of his radar screen. But as we already indicated, in the medieval period, philosophers believed in the concept, in theory, of nevuah, of prophecy. And the philosopher who spoke to the king of the Khazars said, you know who can actually achieve nevuah, who can actually achieve prophecy? It's really the philosopher, because when the philosopher unites with the active intellect, the great brain which is up there in the heavens, he can plug into that incredible source of wisdom and, you know, so to speak, download it to his own brain and his own understanding, and that's how he can become a prophet. So turns around the king of the cases to the philosopher and says, yeah, show me one philosopher who ever prophesied. Show me one Navi among the philosophers. You can't. I mean, the philosophers, in theory, spoke about the concept of nevuah, but the only recorded instances of nevuah that we have, says the king of the Khazars, are to be found among the members of those organized religions. Again, you know, let's put aside for a moment who's right, but the Jews claim to have prophets, the Christians claim to have prophets, the Muslims claim to have prophets, the philosophers talk about philosophy, talk about prophecy, but nobody ever came forward and said, hi, you know, I have a dual degree in philosophy and prophecy. I mean, they sound almost the same. You know, he could maybe, you know, double up some of the courses that he takes in philosophy school. But, you know, we never saw a philosopher come forward and say that he's a prophet. Lishitascha, according to your understanding of things. So philosophers should be running around claiming that they got prophecy as well. The fact that they're not, and the fact that members of organized religions are, makes it sound like this highest realm, this highest rung of human achievement is achieved through organized religion, and is not achievable through philosophy. So again, if you notice, what's going on over here is less of a philosophical back and forth and more of an argument from experience. Experientially, what the philosophers claim to be able to achieve, they don't actually claim to have achieved. Whereas the members of the other organized religions claim that they can achieve prophecy through their derech, through their, you know, path in life. Now again, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but at least they make the claim that they actually did so. You know, you guys don't even submit a claim that you ever achieved prophecy. V'zemorek yesh ladover ha'eloki sod acher zulas mashiz zocharta. All of this shows us that there must be some other way to God other than the philosophy that you're talking about. So basically the king of the cases dismisses the philosopher. You know, again, experience and the innate drive of human beings to believe in some kind of revealed religion from our own experience shows that there must be more than that's just the philosophy that you're developing. So says the Kuzari, אחר כך אומר הכוזרי בליבו, אשל אדום וישמואל, כי אחד משני המסים הוא הנרצה מאין ספק. Okay, we got rid of the philosopher. So now I'm going to call in representatives of the Christians and of the Muslims. And he goes on to say something very interesting. אבל היהודים, but when it comes to the Jews, says the king of the cases, I don't think I'm even going to bother calling in a representative from the Jews. Why? Daily bamashu hu nira mishiflusam umiutam v'sheakol moasim osam. Look, the Jews are a minority. They're a persecuted minority. They're a despised minority. Obviously, they can't have the truth. Right? So this argument is consistent with the earlier argument of the king of the Khazars. In other words, you know, truth is to be found in numbers. Right? The masses have the truth. So, you know, the philosophers are a minority. They're a significant minority, so I heard them out. But they're still a minority. Most people in the world believe in some kind of organized religion. So what are the two big organized religions in the world? Well, there's Christianity and Islam. So being that they're so powerful and command so many adherents, one of them must be correct. The only thing I have to figure out now is which one is correct. Is it Christianity or is it Islam? Right? And as when I make the new flag for my country, am I going to put a Salem on it or am I going to put a crescent on it? That's the only thing that I have to figure out, you know, at this point in time. But the Jews, it's not even worth my while to call in the Jews, because as a minority, by definition, they can't be right. So obviously we know that, you know, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to advocate for the Jews. I mean, most of the Sefer is going to be, you know, exploring Judaism. We're not going to spend an awful lot of time exploring Christianity and Islam. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to have to come up with a convincing answer to walk, you know, kind of have his cake and eat it too over here. On the one hand, philosophy is wrong because the masses, you know, embrace the idea of an organized religion. On the other hand, if you put too much stock in that concept of truth is with the masses, so then how do we bring Yiddishkeit into the picture? Because after all, you know, the masses, you know, have gone for the other two religions. You know, Judaism is a despised minority in the world. We must be wrong, you know, the king of the Khazars says, because after all, if we're a minority, obviously we're wrong. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to have to figure out a way to have his cake and eat it too.
So, I don't understand why he would put so much emphasis on the majority of what people are, you know, agreeing with. Why it wouldn't be obvious that even if it is something that's a minority, that it could be
the
truth.
Right. Right. So the truth is that was a common belief that philosophers had. Again, Aristotle said such a thing, that, you know, truth is with the masses. The Rambam, again, on our side of the fence, you know, echoed such an idea. And the truth is, if you think about it, you know, much of Western society, in a sense, is built on that idea as well. I mean, we're going tomorrow, we have election day. Right? Whoever's going to get the most votes, we hope, is going to be put into office. Right? That's the difference between America and other countries, right, that have democracies. In America, the people who get most of the votes, we think, actually end up in office. In other countries, the people who get the most votes don't necessarily end up in office, even if it's a democratic process officially. Right? But, I mean, democracy is based on the idea that if the majority of people believe a certain thing, that's probably the best way to go.
But then don't you also have to look at the type of people that are the majority? I mean, if you're looking at people that are laymen and uneducated,
right,
you know, as opposed to maybe scholars and mm-hmm. people that are more educated, wouldn't you tend to like lean towards something that's a little more knowledgeable?
Yeah, absolutely. Although, by the way, in America, we don't believe that.
No.
Well, right? I mean, you know, just... You ever served on a jury, you know, that's how it goes. But no, I mean, America, we don't believe that. In other words, you know, if a candidate, you know, gets 75% of the vote because he likes the color purple, and 70% of the voters like the color purple also, so he gets the office, you know, regardless of how, you know, how inane, you know, that point of view may be. But the truth, you know, even applied to over here. Look, Chachma Bagayim Tamin. In other words, there were certainly scholars among the philosophers, there were certainly scholars among the Christians, certainly scholars among the Muslims. You know, I'm not sure that that argument, you know, by itself would be enough to establish, well, you know, the Jews clearly have all the scholars, you know, so therefore, you know, even though they're a minority, they're much more likely to be right. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of, you know, learning and education and insight, you know, which was among the other three groups as well. So okay, so the Karel Chacham Chachme Edom. So the next step that the king of the Kaisers has is he calls in a Christian scholar. V'shal al Chachmaso Maaseu v'Amar Lo. So he interviews the Christian, and he asks, you know, tell me a little bit about your religion. The Christian says as follows. So first of all, Ani Mamin b'Chidush Hanivros v'Kadmus Habari Yisborach. First of all, I believe that whereas God is eternal, the world was created. I'm not a philosopher. Right, and as I do believe that the world, you know, has a beginning and has an end. You know, the world is not eternal, you know, unlike the point of view of the philosophers. V'shehu bara ha'olam kula b'shisha yamim, says the Christian. I believe that God created the world in 6 days, as it says in the Bible. V'shekol ha'medabim tzetzoi Adam v'achri chen tzetzoi Noach. And all of humanity that's alive today descended originally from Adam and afterwards from Noach. I believe that God interacts and cares about the affairs of human beings, and that He can connect to human beings. I believe God reveals Himself to His prophets and to His wise people and to His pious people. And that God dwells among His chosen people, you know, that God chooses a select group of people and dwells among them. So far, if you didn't know there was a Christian talking, this could be a Jew speaking. Klolo shel davar, and here's a very important line to sum up what I've said till now. Ani mamin b'choma shebo b'Torah v'sifrei b'nei Yisrael. I believe everything in the Torah, says the Christian scholar, and everything in the books of the Jews. Asher ein sofek b'amitosam. There's no denying the things that are in the books of the Jews and the Torah. Bavur pirsumum v'hasmadosam v'galosam v'hamonim gedolim. Because the various events which are described in the Torah and the Tanakh were displayed in front of the masses. They got large publicity. Again, this is a very important argument that the Kuzari is going to come back to. Maimed Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, was a public event which took place in front of thousands, if not millions, of individuals. Right? So therefore, there's no denying the various events which are described in Tanakh. So says the Christian scholar, I believe in all of that, Be'emunah Shleima, I'm good. Right? You know, there's everything that the Jews believe in, I believe in as well. But I have a little bit to add. Uv'achrisam uv'ikvosam nigshima ha'elokus. At a certain point in history, God took human form. V'hoya uber berechem besula minasios b'nei Yisrael. And God became a fetus in the in the uterus of a virgin that came from a very chashuv Jewish family, a very important Jewish family. V'yalda oso enoshi hanire eloki hanistar. And this woman, this virgin, gave birth to an individual who appeared human but was secretly a god. Navi shaluach benire, from as far as we could tell, he appeared to be a prophet. Eloka shaluach banistar, but in really point of fact, he was a hidden god who was sent out to the world. V'hu ha-Moshiach hanikro ben Elokim. And this individual is the Messiah and the Son of God. V'hu ha-Ov, v'ha-Bein, v'hu Ruach HaKodesh. He's the Father, he's the Son, he's the Holy Ghost. Right? Goes mamish, you know, it's 2 pages, but you could get all of Christianity, basically, whatever the Kuzari tells you. V'anachnu miyachdim amitosa. By the way, we believe that he's really one, says the Christian scholar. And even if you hear us talking in terms of the Trinity, you should understand what we call three is really one. We believe that all three parts of this God, the Av, the Bein, and the Ruach HaKodesh, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, we believe that all of them really are one unit. It's not, you know, it's not one plus one plus one, but it's one third plus one third plus one third. All of them together come up to one. When this God, you know, came among the Jewish people and sought to dwell among them as a source of covet, as a source for glory for them, it was everything was great. Until the masses of the Jews rebelled against this Moshiach, they rejected him and they hanged him. They crucified him. And because of that, God's anger was directed against the Jews constantly, eternally, and against the masses of the Jews. But the only favor that God showed any of the Jews was for those few individuals who were still steadfast in their belief to follow this Moshiach, right? God is angry at most of the Jews, but the few group, that stalwart group of Jews who still believe in him, even after he's been put to death, that's really who God chose, you know, and God is showing them favor. And then God transferred his favor, you know, away from the Jewish people. Originally God had shown favor to the Jewish people, but now God preferred to show favor to those Gentiles who would now go and follow that small group of Jews who still believed and still clung to the belief that this individual was the Messiah and the Son of God. The Imlo Niyya Bibnei Yisrael, it's true that we're not Jewish, says this Christian scholar. And according to what I said, God shows the Jewish nation and showed them special favor. So you might ask, so where do I come, you know, where do I come off, you know, claiming anything special for ourselves? Anachnu yoser re'uyim shenikare b'nei Yisrael. Really, says the Christian scholar, we're better than the Jews. We deserve the title children of Israel more so than the Jews themselves do. Why? Mipnei she'anachnu holchim acharei divrei ha-Moshiach. Because we followed the Messiah that God sent down to the Jewish people, and the Jews rejected him. We clung to him. And therefore, even though we're not Jewish by birth, and we've only adopted this religion because of the few Jews who, you know, who continued their belief in this Messiah, nonetheless, you know, we deserve to be called the new Israel, the new group of Bnei Israel, more so than the original Jews that were chosen by God. And isn't it interesting, says the Christian scholar, that the students, the apostles of this Messiah, numbered 12, just like the Shvatim, right? So in other words, just like the Shvatim created, just like the sons of Yaakov Avinu created the Jewish people, so too, it's not by accident that there were 12 disciples, because they were creating a new Jewish people, so to speak, you know, which came out from this messianic figure, and we are all, you know, part of that group. V'hoyinu anu ru'uyim l'malas b'nei Yisrael. We deserve all of the great things that are promised to the Jewish people. V'chol ha'umos nikros el amuna hazos. Our faith is one which attracts nations from all around the world. U'mitzuvim l'davek bo. We are all called to cling to our religion. L'gadil l'romim l'amoshiach. To exalt the Messiah who came to us. U'l'gadil es eitzo asher nisla alav. And we also have the obligation to show respect to the eitz, to the tree upon which he was hung. What does that mean? In other words, we take the crucifix, the tzelem, right? And we incorporate it into every aspect of our lives and we show it covered, right? And that's the way we go about doing things. V'dineinu v'chukeinu mimitzvas Shimon HaChaver. Where did we get all of our rules from? From Shimon HaChaver. Shimon the Chaver. So Shimon HaChaver is Peter, right? Who, again, there's a tradition that goes back, very, very, very interesting tradition that goes back to Jewish sources, that Peter himself, Paul, was Shaul, right? That's, you know, the names are very similar to one another. But Peter, there's an ancient Jewish tradition that he was, that his original name was Shimon, that he was a Jew, who, you know, his Greek name was Peter, his Hebrew name was Shimon, that he was a Talmud of one of the Tanoim, I think Rabbi Nechunya HaKana, if I'm not mistaken, that's the way the tradition goes, and that he's basically the one who, from a Jewish perspective, was involved in developing all of the rites and perspectives of Christianity after the crucifixion. So we go back to Shimon HaChaver, right? And you put his name on your besmedrash. It sounds like a regular Jewish religion. V'chukim min haTorah she'anu lomdim osa. And, you know, besides what we got from the Chaver Shimon, we get everything from the Torah. Ve'in safek b'amitasa, shimei esa Elokim. The Torah itself, we believe wholeheartedly came from God. We don't deny the truth of the Jewish Torah, of the Tanakh. Ukvar ba ba'avengelion b'divrei ha-Moshiach. In the evangelion, like evangelical, right? And it was in the New Testament, we have quoted the words of our Moshiach who tells us, Lo bosi listor mitzvah mi mitzvos b'nei Yisrael. I haven't come to throw away any of the Jewish mitzvahs. U'moshe neviyam. Right? And I haven't come to deny the truth of Moshe, the great prophet of the Jewish people. Avol bosi l'chazkam u'la'amtsam. My whole purpose, says Oso Ha'ish, is quoted in the Christian Bible, is simply to come and to reinforce and to strengthen the laws of the Torah and the ideas of the Tanakh. Right? Now again, obviously this is one strain within Christianity. Another strain within Christianity, you know, held that kashrus and Shabbos and all of the things that make Yiddishkeit, what it is, were things that obviously are not applicable anymore, but there is certainly, a point of view that's advocated within the Christian Bible, that nothing is being rejected from Yiddishkeit. The truth of the Torah, the truth of the revelation at Har Sinai is absolutely accepted. And basically Christianity, in a sense, is picking up where they feel that Judaism has left off.
So is this where the Messianic Jews come from? Unfortunately, I had the experience of meeting with Messianic Jews in the Messianic Temple.
Right. Right. So this is Christianity itself. In other words, the way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is portraying it, which again you see, I mean, he obviously knew a lot about Christianity, right? In other words, he was very well aware, even to the point of quoting, even to the point of quoting the New Testament. But basically, that is the fundamental belief of Christianity itself. Judaism is correct, right? It's just that the New Testament comes and adds, and in certain senses supersedes, that which came before. But in other words, the Tanakh itself is a correct text. It's part of the Holy Scripture. The miracles described in the Tanakh took place and are things that they believe in. And ad hayom, again, you know, to this day, the sanctity of you know, what we call the Tanakh, what they call the Old Testament, is something which, you know, the Christian world still believes in. It's a very fascinating tshuva from the Rambam. The Rambam was asked about the propriety of teaching Torah to non-Jews. And the Rambam writes, there's a difference between Christians and Muslims. So Muslims, you shouldn't teach Torah to. Christians, you can't teach Torah to. So why? So the Rambam writes, because the Muslims reject the sanctity of the Torah Shebikhsav. Right? In other words, they accept many of the principles that Judaism is based on, but the book itself, in other words, they hold in many respects it's falsified. Now, to take a very famous example, if you ask a Muslim about the Akedah, you know, so they'll tell you, yeah, the Akedah, sure, Avram took Yishmael and bound him onto the altar, right? The Chumash says, Heintek Esedra, right? I mean, the Chumash says that it was Yitzchak Avinu, the Jews perverted everything, right? They came along and they made up their own stories, right? So the Muslims really, although they, again, they accept many of the concepts, you know, which Judaism believes in, they accept the concept of revelation, Har Sinai, and the like, but in terms of the specific text of the Tanakh, they don't accept it. Says the Rambam, so you're going to argue, you're going to start teaching Torah to a Muslim, all they're going to do is take the information that you give them, and they're going to use it as ammunition against the Jews. Right? The more they know, the more they're going to post anti-Semitic websites and, you know, just make life miserable for us. But says the Rambam, but a Christian who actually believes in Torah Shebikhsav, right, and believes that the text of the Torah, the way we have it is sacred, right, the text of the Torah Nevim Uksuvim, the only thing is the Christians have a different interpretation. Again, we believe a mistaken interpretation of many of the psukim. So if a pasuk in Yeshaya says, Hinei ha'alma hara v'yoladis bein, right, so whereas we interpret that, you know, because we know Hebrew, as behold, a young woman is going to give birth to a child. So, you know, in the Christian Bible, they understand that to mean, behold, a virgin is pregnant, she's going to give birth to a child. But you know what? If you sit down with an honest Christian, says the Rambam, and you go through a little bit of Hebrew with them, right, and then you go through a little bit of Tanakh with them, you'll actually run the chance of changing their minds, right? Now, again, I mean, it's important to remember the Rambam lived in a Muslim society. I mean, had he actually sat down with medieval Christians, I don't know how far he would have gotten. But but he said, look, in theory, you know, being that their religion accepts the sanctity of the Torah Shebikhsav, they should be open to having their mistakes corrected. So yeah, why not? Go ahead and teach them. I should point out a lot of Achronim, most Achronim probably disagree with this Rambam halacha lemaisa in practical terms. But you know, nonetheless, you know, the Rambam is very telling in that he shows us that really, you know, the Christians did accept, you know, the sanctity and continue to accept the sanctity of the Torah Shebikhsav. They accept the basic storyline of Jewish history. It's just that at a certain point they hold that something else happened and was added on, and that's where their religion, you know, basically is kind of alongside of ours up to a point, and then it really swerves off in a totally different direction. So that's evidenced, you know, by the way the Yudah Alevi presents the arguments of the Christian over here in talking to the king. Right, so we'll see in a minute the answer that the king gives. And again, the king is supposed to be coming from an outside objective perspective. You know, what's his answer to Christianity? Right, so Omar HaKuzari, Ein bekan makom l'svara. There is no logic in anything you said whatsoever. Right? In fact, achasvara mirachekes rov hadvarim ha'ela. The more I think about what you're saying logically, the less it makes sense. Right? He doesn't even bother going into things in detail, but you know, no doubt that's one of the points that he has in mind. God came into a human body and changed himself into a fetus, and he came out. And so what? What are you talking about? You know, I mean, we're used to it already, you know, for better, for worse, because that's what a good part of the good portion of the world believes at this particular point in time. But, you know, the king of the Kusari says to the Christian scholar, nothing you're saying makes any sense. I mean, there's no logic in anything you're saying whatsoever. Now, here again, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi finds himself in a very funny position, because again, in a sense, he's trying to have his cake and eat it too. Because on the one hand, the philosopher gave all these rational, logical arguments, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's answer through the king of the Kesars is, you know what, let's not talk about logic and philosophy, let's just talk about experience. Most people experience this idea that there's supposed to be this innate truth to religion. So, you know, I'm not going to get into the logic and philosophy, because what you're saying sounds good maybe from a logical perspective, but it doesn't feel right. So now the Christian, in a sense, and you can see the artistry, by the way, in the way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi set this up, the Christian is almost like the polar opposite of the philosopher. The Christian basically comes with a whole system of beliefs which have very little to, you know, to, if anything, to support them logically, right? It's all about, we feel this, we believe this, you know, we can't prove this, but, you know, this is what our heart tells us is true, right? So now Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in the you know, speaking through the king of the cases, comes back and says, well, that doesn't meet the test of logic. But wait a minute, but we weren't interested in the test of logic when dealing with the philosopher, so how come all of a sudden, you know, you're whipping out the logical argument over here? You know, if you were interested in logic, you should have spoke logic to the philosopher. So he tells us a very important yesod. Says the king of the Kesars, you know, in life we sometimes encounter things which at first glance don't seem to us to make sense, right? That they seem illogical. But when you see something with your own eyes, as much as it doesn't really seem to make sense to your seichel, you realize that it has to be true. Right? You know, if I wouldn't have seen it, I would never have believed it. Okay, but now that you saw it, you gotta believe it. Right? Again, I mean, you can say, okay, there's sleight of hand at play over here or something like that. But in other words, even things that seem to be illogical, you accept once you actually see them with your own eyes. Right, it's for those who were Sherlock Holmes fans once upon a time, it's a befeirish of Sherlock Holmes. Once you eliminate the impossible, what's left is the improbable. Right? It's, you know, okay, so you can't, not everything makes sense, but, you know, once you eliminate the things which for sure don't make sense, even things which don't seem to make sense, but that seems to be what's in front of you, so you have no choice, you know, but to accept that point of view. So says the king of the Kesars to the Christian, the things you're saying seem absolutely illogical. If I could see some kind of proof with my own eyes, I would buy them. I would accept them. If somehow I would see something that would make it clear to me that a god could come into a, you know, a woman's uterus and somehow be born as a child, if I could see something that would convince me of that, all right, I don't think that makes any sense logically, but if I saw it, I would be forced to accept it and forced to believe it. But you're basically leaving me high and dry on two levels, he says to the Christian. What you're saying doesn't make any sense, and you really have no good proofs that would move me to actually believe it. Right? So, both logic as well as experience play a role. Things you don't have to necessarily reject things just because they're illogical, but there has to be some kind of, and again it comes back to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's point, which he hammers home again and again, if a person has an experience that leads him to think that X is true, that will lead him, you know, to even overcome what seems to be a lack of logic. But here in the case of Christianity, there doesn't seem to be any experience that I have, says the king of the Kesars, which would lead me to accept these strange propositions which you're putting forward.
So what would the Kuzari king have accepted as experiential proof? he had to have seen it, or eyewitness reports by others who claim to have seen it.
Right. So
that's what they do have.
Right. So I mean, what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is ultimately going to lead up to is that Torah is demonstrated by the eyewitness accounts of thousands of people.
So,
right.
So it's the limitation of the limitation of numbers of the eyewitness.
Right. In other words, had the resurrection in Christianity taken place, in front of thousands of people, right? So then, then we would have what to talk about. I mean, that's what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is implying, right? As it is, no one witnessed the resurrection itself. And at best, you have a few solitary people who claim to have found the tomb empty. Okay, finding a tomb empty is not quite the same. If you told me, I was standing there, and I watched him, get up and brush himself off, and wash negovas or whatever, we have the basis of a discussion. But short of that, the amount of experiential proof that we have is very, very scanty.
Would he have accepted this reason that we gave, the masses believe that it therefore must be true? There is a critical mass of people that do believe.
Right. So that's the fine line that we come back to, where, again, he's trying to have his cake and eat it too. The masses believing something is significant where there's some experiential proof to back it up. I mean, basically what he's going to come down to is, when you really strip away what the masses believe in, since the masses embrace Christianity and Islam, and the good parts of Christianity and Islam, which can be, if not verified absolutely, but at least ring true with our experience, are all based on Judaism, in a sense, the masses really do believe in Judaism. They just don't realize it. Right? In other words, any Christian is basically believing in Judaism plus a lot of other things which don't make any sense. Right? So the things which don't make sense we'll throw out the window because, there's no way to verify them. So when you strip those things away, what's left is a lot of people who, although they don't profess it as such, they actually are believing Jews, when you strip away what they down to the core of what they basically believe.
Right.
Well, I think, they would just say very simply, how do you know that this is indeed a tradition going back to Moshe at HaSinai? In other words, you tell me that tying these k'shatim l'osa yodecha v'ayula tatofos v'erinecha means tefillin. How do I know that that's true? Right? In other words, the same thing, the truth is the Karaites that he's going to deal with later on say exactly the same thing. So in his, response to the Karaites, that's going to address some of the Christian rejection of Torah Sheba'al Peh as well. So we'll get there, Bez Hashem. Yeah.
Do we really have a lot of people who saw Maamar HaSinai and who saw Yetziat Mitzrayim, or do we just have one person who wrote it down?
Right, so Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is working with the understanding, certainly the way we have the description told to us in Chumash, there's a massive number of people are seeing it. So then the question becomes, okay, well, why can't the following scenario theoretically be true? So one guy sat down, and he just wrote a story about how a lot of people saw something. So, again, we'll get to the argument inside, but classically the argument, starting with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is, well, then how did he foist that off on everybody else? So one day he comes to everybody with a book and says, you didn't realize this, but all of our forefathers were present, in Egypt and saw these miracles, and we came. Yeah? I don't remember hearing anything like that.
If you didn't think that something like that was possible, then all of Christianity wouldn't have been possible, and all of Islam wouldn't have been possible. For one person to claim that they had truth and then force it upon other people.
Right, no, but the claim is a little bit different. In other words, in Christianity, basically, the claim is three people were aware of this. Oh, well, three people aware of this. Okay, well, I trust those three people. Here, the claim is a very audacious one. I mean, the claim basically is all of us are descended from people who experienced these events. even though you never heard of this before I came along. Right? So that's already a different type of, you know, in Christianity, okay, so look, if I'm willing to believe those three people, I'm willing to believe those three people. Here you're not just claiming about the event is, you know, about the event itself, you're claiming about the involvement of everyone that I know, you know, again, through their forefathers, in this kind of, in this event that took place. That requires a certain boldness, you know, that Christianity doesn't make in its claim. Right? So again, we'll get to it inside, but ultimately it's that kind of experience, you know, which is the claim behind Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Right? So basically says the king of the Kesars to the Christian scholar, you know, being that you haven't really brought me any proof, and these things seem to me to be utterly illogical, and I have no reason to believe them, right? I don't think the truth lies in Christianity either. So the next thing he does is to call in a Muslim cleric, a Muslim scholar, and he starts to investigate Islam. So with that, Be'ezat Hashem, we'll pick up next time. You know, we talked about Christianity tonight, we'll talk about Islam next time, and then Be'ezat Hashem, finally following that, we'll actually get to Judaism, which is going to occupy us for most of the time, and we'll see how, based on some of the outlooks of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, he starts defending, you know, the Jewish point of view, and why it's even worth the while of the King of the Kesars to consider Judaism as being a religion. Remember, he wasn't even willing to call in a representative of the Jews, you know, in the first place whatsoever.